So Glenn was so excited when they approached him to plan a cruise through history. He knew he was going to build an amazing experience for you, seeing the birthplace of the Republic, commerce, and our faith that inspired our founding fathers with the idea that man could rule himself will be such an incredible learning experience for you and your family. You need to join Glenn Beck, Bill O'Reilly, Stu, David Barton, and Rabbi LePin on a 14-day adventure next spring on a cruise through history. Come walk where Jesus and the prophets walked in the Holy Land, Italy, Greece, Croatia, with Bill O'Reilly, David Barton, Rabbi LePin, Stu, and Glenn himself. This is going to be a cruise like no other, and he is incredibly excited to share it with you. So you need to come be a part of it. You're going to get incredible amenities along with the cruise. You're going to be just going to be a fantastic adventure of a lifetime. It's going to be a memory for you and your family you'll never forget. This all-inclusive trip, including all airfare and gratuities, that comes out to about $360 per day. You just need to put down a deposit, and then you can pay over time. Early bird discount of $400. Visit comesailaway.com and get on the boat. Comesailaway.com. Go there today. Party time, Mom. What's up? We're back here at Studio 22 hanging out for the Chad Prather Show. That's me. And you're welcome, America, and the rest of the world. We just always having a blast in here. And Party Foul, what is the deal with that shirt you're wearing right there?
What?
Party Foul.
That's a throwback Party Foul shirt.
Here's what we're going to do with the Party Foul brand. We're going to do some vintage T-shirts. And I want to tell everybody, you could still get the PFAF shirts. And if you don't know what the AF stands for,
it's not for
probably
you.
Don't want to wear that shirt out there. But it's a fun little design. Steve, we sold a bunch of those shirts.
Yes.
But I want to do some vintage throwbacks with that. And then do you have your cup over there with the old logo on there?
I want to
do a throwback with some of those, but put them on real good T-shirts, not the cheap crap that you used to make.
Yeah.
So we're going to make some real stuff.
They still sold.
I know, right?
It's like,
yeah. So let me tell you the story about partyfoul.com, okay? I haven't told you yet, Steve. So I bought partyfoul.us. I wanted partyfoul.com. It is actually available, but someone owns it. So I let GoDaddy go negotiate for us for partyfoul.com. I said, I'm willing to spend up to $2,000. Now, my wife's going to watch this. She's going to get mad, right? I said, I'm willing to spend up to $2,000. The guy comes back and says he wants $7,500 for partyfoul.com. Oh. I said, I'm not doing that. Offer him $3,000. He comes back and he says, he'll take $5,500. He said, do you want to offer him $4,000? I said, no, I think we're going to stick with partyfoul.us. So, I mean, that's a lot of T-shirts we'd have to sell, Steve.
Yeah, that is a lot, but.
But it ain't your money. But, Mark, do you hear what I deal with?
I have like six other websites that are all.
I know you do.
Related that. I just couldn't get that. I tried to get that one five or 6 years ago. I just couldn't do it.
Yeah. Well, who knows? You know, if God's in it, it'll happen.
Yeah.
If God wants to fund our debaucherous website.
That guy sitting there with that website, his electricity is fixing to get cut off.
Well, I just said, we're capping it right there. And if he wants it, he wants it. Natalie, you want to go in on some partyfoul.com?
No.
we're going to have Hot News Natalie shirts on there. Sorry.
Well, here's what I want to do. Yeah, well, so here's what we're doing.
I actually was thinking, I'm going to the show this weekend. I can wear PFAF.
Yeah, you sure
can. But you're going to have to get it to me.
I'll get it to you.
I'll advertise it.
I'll come to your house in the middle of the night and bring it.
Great.
Y'all are
a mess.
That
is great.
So anyway, this is pre-recorded. There is not a show this weekend in Huntsville. That's already happened in the world of entertainment. But no, I'm happy sitting over here in the hot seat. Remy Adeleke.
Yes, sir.
How bad did I slaughter that name?
That was pretty good. Adeleke, yeah.
Adeleke. Well, somebody had given me your name. They said, well, how would you pronounce it? And I said, I would go with Adeleke. And good to see you, man.
Yeah,
glad you're
too,
in here.
Yeah.
You know, you have got a heck of a story.
Thank you.
That I want to talk about. And if you've been watching movies like Transformers, you probably see Remy in there. And that's a sweet gig.
Yeah.
I would think.
Yeah. Yeah,
and you just did a new movie.
Yeah, Six Underground.
Six Underground.
Yeah.
I keep telling my agent, I'm like, get me in a movie.
Yeah, man, it could just be one scene.
I know. Just get me in there. I don't need the money. Well, The money, money's nice.
Money is good.
Money's nice. I'll keep the day job. Yeah. Just give me, you know, let me get out there.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's good work, good pay, good chow on the right? set. Hey,
gotta love craft services.
Yeah, I love them.
Isn't that great?
Yes, sir.
What's funny is we have friends who will come to certain shows in different regions where we're at, different parts of the country. And we always know which ones are coming just so they can come and get off our tour rider.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And they're like, hey, I'm just going to fix some sandwiches, take them back to the room here. I'm like, what the heck? You know, but yeah, people don't know, man.
Yeah.
It's like craft services are nice.
Oh, it can make or break a day.
How'd you get into the acting world?
I was in grad school doing my master's in organizational strategy. My phone rang one day and this lady was like, hey, Michael Bay is starting his new film Transformers. You know, he's looking for a former Navy SEAL. What's your background? Are you available? And then that's how I got into the next day. I was on set. That one day turned into 3 weeks. 3 weeks turned into 6 months on the film. And then that opened up other doors for me in the film and TV industry. I was not searching for it at all.
So when they're looking for a role like that, are they trying to find somebody that tactically is accurate?
Yeah, that was the main piece. Bay, he's used Navy SEALs in his film since The Rock back in 96. So they were looking for somebody who could shoot, move, and communicate on camera so that it looks authentic when the audience views it.
I was talking to different friends, some Benghazi survivors, and I always, every time I'm around those guys, I'm like, hey, you know that scene in 13 Hours? And they were like, it's Michael Bay. He's gone. There were no cars blowing up. There was a lot of bullets flying in Benghazi that night, but there was not any cars blowing up.
Oh, you know, if Bay's doing a film, there is going to be at least one explosion.
I know. You gotta blow things up. And I was like, well, you know, you got to make a movie like that. So yeah. Michael Bay film.
Yeah.
But congratulations on the success, and I wish you a whole lot more.
Because
I love knowing movie stars personally.
So. Well, I'm not. I want to say myself.
Oh no, it's coming.
Wait, I can't minimize that. Yeah, so I'll take it if it comes. I'll take it.
I know, man. Yeah. It's coming.
Yeah,
it's coming. But you know, here's the problem. Like, if they put me in a movie, and all of a sudden I started getting some phone calls like that. Party Foul Steve would think he automatically should be in the movie too.
Well, why?
And I was, wasn't I?
Yeah, we did do a movie, and you were an extra.
I was an extra.
What movie was it? What movie was it?
We did a movie called. Oh gosh!
It wasn't that bad. You already forgot.
Heroes Among Us. Heroes Among Us. And let me tell you what made me feel weird, Remy. Because so they wanted me to play a 20-year master sergeant, who was retiring, coming out, and trying to adjust into. It wasn't the typical like PTSD thing.
Yeah.
It was trying to adjust to civilian world after being in that world for 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so I felt weird because obviously I'm a supporter of our veterans and our military.
Yeah.
But for me to put that uniform on and a friend who was a consultant, I'm wearing his gear and his armor and stuff. And I was like, is this okay? Well, Mark Wahlberg can do it.
Oh, yeah, he does it.
But, you know, we had the consultants right there on set who were just saying, okay, you would do this and you would do this. And this is how you would body language and you carry yourself. It's a little intimidating.
No, it could totally be. I mean, that's one of the jobs that I've done a lot in the film and TV industry as well, is the consulting.
Yeah.
And you know, the cool thing is I've been able to work with some actors who are they respect veterans, and they lean on us.
Yeah.
And some of them have that same notion as well, where they're just like, should I be saying this? Should I be doing this? I want to get it right. So
Yeah, we had at the end of it, I'll toot my own horn. I have this philosophy: he who tooteth not his own horn remains in a perpetual state of untootedness. So I'm gonna toot my own horn here. The one of the directors on the film, she said, "I cried at that last scene when you walking down that hall." I just, you know, and I was like, "Nailed it!"
Yeah,
she said, "I've never cried at a scene before when we were shooting it." She said, "That was real." And then the consultant came up and he said, You nailed it. I was like, yes.
Oscar might be in your future.
Yeah. I can do this thing.
Yeah.
No, I've always been fascinated with it. It's a blast. Mm-hmm. But as a Navy SEAL, from your perspective, what's the attitude in Hollywood? I know the general consensus.
Yeah.
But what's the attitude with the folks you work with?
In the film and TV industry?
Yeah, film and TV industry towards veterans.
You know, I mean, all the people that I've worked with, they've been super respectful to me. I've never had any issues. A lot of doors have opened for me. And I mean, all of the doors that have opened for me in the film and TV industry has solely been because I'm a veteran. I'm a Navy SEAL specifically.
Yeah.
So I haven't had any pushback. Even now, you know, I've gotten into writing and producing, and I'm in talks with a studio now and to turn my content into films and TV shows. And it's just been like, come. Show us what you got. Like, we're open to receive your ideas and your concepts. And I think a lot of it is, you know, you have all of these action films that come out and they want it. Hollywood wants to make it as authentic as possible. And there's been shows like SEAL Team on CBS where all the consultants on that show and some of the writers in the writer's room are former SEALs or former Delta. So they see the benefit of having those type of guys on set.
Yeah, a buddy of mine has a recurring role on the SEAL Team.
Yeah.
He's not former military, but he's ripped and he's a really beautiful man.
What's his name?
I hate that.
What's his name? Do I know him?
I'll show you. We'll hook you up on Instagram. Zadrian is his name. He's from overseas, obviously, with a name like Zadrian. He goes by Z because nobody can pronounce his name. Americans. but that's an interesting thing, though, because I'm out in Hollywood a good bit, and we've pitched everything. And coming from my perspective, as a people would consider me a conservative comedian, a right of center. I just call it, I just common sense. I make fun of everybody. I don't care. But that reputation kind of goes before you, and then you meet with Fox and CBS and NBC and ABC and all these guys, and they're kind of like looking at you like, this guy, he's an alien from Texas. What is this guy?
What is he going to say?
So everybody's always been gracious. Everybody's always been gracious. But here's what I want to talk about. Every time we have somebody come in here, look how handsome this is, man. Right here. I'm going to get it where the lights are. It's hard on that.
There's no Photoshop on that. There's no Photoshop on that.
Transformed. If you can't read that. And that's great, see, because you could do a movie called Transformers that nobody's heard of, and then write a book called Transform and jump right off of that. So you were born in Nigeria.
Yes, sir.
And
yes,
you and I have that in common. Not that I was born there, but I've been there a lot.
You've been there enough to probably be able to say you were born there.
I'm passable in Yoruba.
I am Yoruba.
Depends on which taxi cab I get into, what part of the city, you know what I'm saying? But I always love that because, honestly, I'm always running into Nigerians in the big cities.
Yeah.
And I love conversing with them and talking about eating pounded yam and a goosey.
Jollof rice.
Yes. And getting suya and just all the goat meat and
peanut stew.
The pepe and the peanut, I know.
Yeah.
I don't miss any of that.
It sticks to your ribs. It sticks to your ribs.
Pounded yam definitely does.
Yeah.
How did you get to America?
Yeah, so my dad, he was a well-known Nigerian engineer, businessman, philanthropist. He was very successful, but in Nigeria, there's a lot of corruption. Historically, it's been consistently ranked as one of the most corrupt nations in the world. And my dad, he man-made one of the first man-made islands in the world, Banana Island, and he had invested millions and millions and millions of dollars into this island to not only develop it, but also to build on it. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, in 1987, the Nigerian government, they stripped my father of his most valuable asset, and he had dumped everything into it, and he died days later.
Oh, wow.
So we went from rich, traveling the world, nannies, cars, drivers, living on a compound, having servants, all of these things, to poor, just like that. And my mom, she was from New York. I tell people all the time that my mom and dad's story is the real coming to America story.
Yeah.
Because they met in the States, and then they got married 5 months later. My mom, being this New Yorker, was, you know, flown out to Nigeria to experience this lavish life. So when my dad died, my mom was just like, there's no way I'm raising my two boys here in Africa. And that's when she permanently relocated us to New York City, the Bronx.
How old were you at that time?
I was five.
Five.
Yeah.
And so you went from, I'm assuming, living in Lagos?
Victoria Island.
Oh, Victoria Island.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
And then to the Bronx.
To the Bronx, yeah.
And that's a sudden change.
Yeah.
I mean, that's all of a sudden, you go from culture to culture.
Yeah, man. Yeah.
Completely different.
Yeah.
How was that growing up in the Bronx? What affected you growing up, and what were the results?
Early on, you know, 5, 6, 7, you know, I didn't really understand the change. I didn't actualize the change. And I would say that because my mom, she did a great job of painting, and I would say, this movie set. And on a movie set, everything seemed perfect. We had Nigerian books. We had Nigerian artwork in our apartment. We had all of these things. And my mom tried to maintain as much as she could the life that we had in this apartment. But outside of the apartment was the chaos, you know, the financial hardship, was the Bronx, you know. Yeah. And so it wasn't until I was 8 years old that I finally realized what had happened. You know, I finally realized my dad had died, you know, And then, you know, looking at our situation, going to with my mom to the rent office and seeing her having to ask for extra time, sharing clothes with my brother, having to wash her underwears and socks in the sink. That's when I was like, what's going on? We don't have the life we used to have anymore. And that's when I intrinsically, that's when I started searching for a father. I started trying to find a father because in my mind, if I had a father, our life would be a lot different. And so that's what led me to the street culture, you know, the hip hop culture at the time. And, you know, I was really, really big into rap and just all of those things. So, you know, when I would hear about selling drugs, that's what I would want to do. When I would hear about stealing, that's what I wanted to would want to do. And I started out stealing from my mom. And then that progressed to, you know, stealing from stores, that progressed to stealing from jobs, and that progressed to selling drugs. And that's progressed to running high level scams. By the time I was 19, I had built this illegal enterprise where I was bringing in $10,000 to $15,000 a week illegally. So that's what not having a father and living in that environment essentially, you know, and it's my fault, right? At the end of the day, a lot of it is my fault because my mom tried to steer me in another direction. She tried to expose me to the arts. She tried to expose me to education. She was a teacher in the South Bronx. As a matter of fact, she would make my brother and I, you know, get New York Times articles, read them, and write reports based off them. So she tried her best, but I was just a boy. When I got older, my mom couldn't, you know, discipline me anymore, so I did my own thing.
It's... First of all, this disclaimer, let's put an asterisk right here. Do not tell the details of your illegal business enterprise because Party Foul Steve will go out and try it.
I was already thinking.
Trust me, I can see the gears clicking in behind his eyes right there. And I'm like, no. See, we have to work hard to keep him redeemed.
Well, that'd be a good way to pay for that .com. That's it.
Get the call that fast quick. Money, right?
There you go.
We don't want to talk about those details at all around Steve. So that disclaimer aside, I'm a huge proponent of this concept of fatherhood and the idea that boys especially, everyone needs their father.
Yeah.
Girls, guys, whatever. But boys need men in their life.
Yeah, I agree.
And we're one of the only cultures on the planet that doesn't have some form of ceremony that calls boys into manhood.
Yeah.
And Western civilization has failed in a big way in that. And then you go into so much of the urban communities where there is no father.
Yeah.
And that, you know, and in the last 50, 60 years, it's become epidemic.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. Do you think that that tide can be turned?
Absolutely. I mean, I think, and that's one of the reasons why I wrote the book. You know, I mean, I truly believe in the power of story. It was through story that I, you know, found out about the SEAL teams and had this idea that maybe one day I could be a SEAL. So, you know, I think through the power of story, absolutely the tide could change. I think also people, men like me and other guys who come from the inner city, especially guys who did not have father, going back into that environment and saying, I'm going to be a father figure to a group of kids, or I'm going to pour into them, or I'm going to show them a way. And when enough people see that, I think that plays a role. And that's what I do. I work in with a nonprofit in San Diego called City Hope, La Mesa City Hope. And part of my job is to just not preach to kids, not beat kids up against the head about joining the military, but just hang out with them, be present with them, show up to their school when they're getting in trouble. And I think that if we can get enough of that, I think that that plays a role in changing the tide. You know, I have there's a saying in this TV show I'm writing called we should be the change we want to see, essentially. And I think that, you know, just going back to the inner city, that could totally change the tide.
Yeah.
Sorry for the long answer.
No, I want the long answer. And I appreciate what you're saying on that because I also believe in the power of story.
Yes.
We had our friend James Robinson on the show here recently, and he made a great point talking about abortion and pro-life and everything that's going on in the country with all that.
Yeah.
And he brought up a great example about how the tide turned in, say, like the addiction to cigarettes as a simple example.
Yeah.
Whenever all those tobacco companies started getting sued years ago and they were forced to actually fund all of these truth campaigns.
And
through the power of these commercials, and they started showing what the statistics looked like.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden people were like, maybe smoking cigarettes isn't that good of an idea. Yeah. And it was that power of story, as graphic as it was, the power of story that kind of turn that tide.
Yeah. Even now with some of those commercials, you see the people with the holes in their neck. It's like, oh man, like I don't want that to happen to me. You know?
And you're, but you're exactly right. It takes somebody with an experience like that to be able to come in and tell their story. That's why this book is so beautiful.
Yes, sir.
And people, and I encourage everybody who listens to this or watches this.
Because
I'm on social media. I got several million people follow me. Yeah. I get tens of thousands of comments a week. Yeah. People are saying these things. I know people care about these things.
Yeah.
But what are you doing to help stem that and to turn that tide? You start, for one thing, right here with this book.
Yeah.
This is a great place.
Thank you.
Get street wisdom and smarts from somebody who's been there, lived it, and still living it.
And can relate.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
That's absolutely the thing. Because you know, I've been all over the world. I've seen a lot of things. Yeah. My experience is still going to be very different from anybody else's.
Yeah.
Look at me. I had never missed a meal. Look at me. You know, I can remember when I had, they used to tell me all the time, they're like, oh, your wife is just so lucky. I was like, yeah, when I had $756 in my bank account and had to figure out how I was going to get 5 days to Monday. Yeah,
she was there.
And I was like, she didn't feel so lucky.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, but it's funny. But even in those days, I never missed a meal.
Yeah,
God's been good to me.
Amen.
And so, you know, but you've had those life experiences, you've had those things, and you're telling that story. Yeah. And it's a one that people need to hear it.
Yeah,
I agree. This is a serious thing in America today.
Yeah, no,
it's fatherlessness.
It's an epidemic. It's an epidemic. And like you said, you know, I truly believe every boy needs a man to teach him how to be a man.
Yeah.
And every girl needs a man, a father, to teach her how to be loved by a man. So that when she goes out and searches for her spouse, she knows exactly what to look for. And she's not running to some knucklehead that is going to beat her and tell her, I love you.
Yeah.
She's going to be able to recognize what love is and isn't immediately. Yeah. And so, yeah, I'm a huge advocate for fathers.
I got five kids. Three of them are my daughters. My three oldest are my daughters. Mm-hmm. Two are off in two different universities in another state.
Oh, good. Congratulations.
And when they were little, I said, you know, I'm going to tell you how beautiful you are.
Amen.
I'm going to tell you how gorgeous you are. I'm going to tell you how smart you are.
Amen.
Because you didn't have anything to do with being beautiful. That's all on me.
Yeah.
Right? I gave you that.
Yeah.
Me and God gave you that. Me and God, your mama gave you that. Yeah. But I can compliment you on your ethic, your standards, you know, working hard, how intelligent, these things that you've accomplished. But I tell them, I said, look, I'm always tell you got pretty blue eyes or pretty green eyes or pretty brown eyes, and the three of them have all three.
Yeah.
And I said, that way when some punk picks you up to go to prom and start saying, oh, you got such pretty, my daddy's already told me that.
Yeah.
You're not telling me things that I don't already know.
Yeah.
That's the power of a dad. That's the power of a father.
Absolutely. Affirmation.
Yeah.
Affirmation. You know, every child needs to be affirmed, because if not, as they get older, they're going to seek affirmation in relationships or in things. I mean, me growing up, you know, I never had a father that said, you know, after five, I didn't have a father that told me, good job. You're a strong man. You're going to be something. Good job on a basketball court. And so intuitively, because I didn't have that, and unbeknownst to me, as I got older, I wanted the car. I wanted the girlfriends. I wanted the gold chain. I wanted, you know, the rims on. I wanted these things because I wanted people to affirm, give me what I never got from my dad. And you see it now, even, you know, with athletes at times. You know, you ask, why are you going to a strip club and making it rain, spending thousands of dollars that you could go to someone. Why are you spending all of this money on all these cars and houses? Why don't you invest properly? And it's because intuitively, we are all looking for that affirmation. We're crying out for it.
Yeah.
And that's the way we feel like we can get it. Yeah.
Well, I can tell you, we don't ever shy away from issues. We talk about everything on this show. And I'll just say it. And people, you know, sometimes I get too blunt with things. I don't think it's too blunt, but it's just honest. You know, you realize how many guys, especially from the African-American community, come out of the NBA after making millions and millions of dollars, and they're bankrupt. Because what did they do? And the NBA has that problem to an epidemic standard, to that level, whereas other pro sports really don't, but the NBA does.
Yeah.
Because they got to have their entourage.
Yep.
Everybody's got to go on vacation to Greece together.
Yep.
And that's exactly right. And it's so many in the African-American community who didn't have that father to affirm them.
Yeah.
So now they got to buy it.
Yeah. And because then those people give you that affirmation, that entourage, the girls, they give you, and you feel, but you know, at the end of the day, you know, even when I was in that, I was still empty. I would receive the affirmation. Yo, man, you the man. Oh, you got that car, all this and that. But I would still go home. It would satisfy me for a moment or two, but I'm still looking for more of it, you know, because it never satisfied me.
Hey, man, I tell you, you were speaking my language because this has been my message for 25 years.
Yeah.
Is this, you know, we dropped one of my boys off this morning. He's trying to make a football team.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
He gets his chance to play for the middle school football team, trying to make a football team. He's one of those guys, great little kid, great athlete, smart. Yeah. He's going to be just fine.
Yeah.
But he's full of self-doubt. What if I don't? What if I You're going to be fine.
Yes,
so we dropped him off this morning at the high school because they're doing strength and conditioning through the summer, right? And I'm like, brother, I'm telling you, just by you going and doing things like this, you're going to make the team.
Yeah.
Coaches are paying attention. they see that you're giving your summer weekdays to go and do, you know, first 4 hours of the day doing strength and conditioning at 12, 13 years old. And those are the kind of things where you look at these kids and they're like, you can see them light up.
Yeah.
You tell them, say, you're going to be just fine.
Yeah.
You need a father to tell you
that.
Yes. And there's folks out there who say, well, I don't have a dad or I don't have a father. And you've certainly got that testimony where you came out of that. And that's why I say, listen, you read the New Testament.
Yeah.
God refers to himself as father more than any other term.
Amen.
And that's the deal. And people do have that father-shaped void in their heart, in their soul, in their life. And ultimately, I think God gave us fathers as an example to show us what a heavenly father is.
I agree 100%. I have a message on that where I tell you know, God fathers us as he fathers. We are to father our children as God fathers us, something along those lines. Yeah. And I kind of give that that parallel between how God fathers his creation and how we as fathers are the father our children. Sorry, I'm chopping it all up. But that's where I learned how to be a father.
Yeah.
Because, you know, when I was 26, that's when, you know, I came to faith, you know, and I would go to the Bible and see, hey, man, how was Jesus with kids? How was God with these kids? And that's how I kind of, I would go to Proverbs to get wisdom. Man, how do I raise, I have three sons. I got three boys and I was a boy without a father. Mm-hmm. So that's where I have to go to get my wisdom. So I know what to do and what not
to do. Yeah, what do I do with this thing?
Yeah.
I don't think that changes with age either. Even at almost 50, I still think, you know, my dad's passed away, but I still, you know, I wish he was here so he could see what I'm doing and would he be proud? Yeah. And you know,
so you take my grandfather, my paternal grandfather died at 94. Mm-hmm. He died the right way, by the way. Let me tell you this story. So he goes there and gets into bed. Yeah. Steve's brain starts working.
Yeah, I'm like,
you're depraved. He goes back there. All the family's there because they knew the time was getting short. He had a home health nurse. He goes back there, lays down in the bed, he's getting ready to go to sleep. So they thought. He rolls over, looks at the nurse, and says, "Go in there and tell everybody I said goodbye." Rolls over and dies.
Oh, wow.
94 years old. That's how you go.
Yeah.
That's how you go.
Yeah.
And so my father who passed away, March was a year ago. My father spent, and he passed way too early, poor health, 75 years old when he passed.
Sorry, man.
But my father, even as an older man, still was trying to get his father's attention because he didn't have a lot of it growing up. My grandfather was a pretty hard guy.
Yeah.
Didn't know how to speak those words of affirmation.
Yeah.
And I agree with you, Steve. You know, when my dad, like my dad had dementia the last 2 years of his life, and he could not see much of the, whatever you want to call it, worldly success that I achieved because his brain wasn't there. And so you do have that desire that's in there. But in your situation, here you are, you're running you got your illegal business empire going on. You're 19, 20 years old.
Yeah.
And then you decide what?
I decide,
what changes?
I get involved in a deal with a drug dealer that goes bad. I sold him some products, not drugs, but a different type of products that were supposed to last for a certain amount of time, and it only lasted for a fraction of that time. And he came knocking on my door. And he essentially threatened my life. He had a reputation in the streets for being a killer. I knew that. And I didn't want to test him.
You didn't want to go see how good the theory was.
Yeah, I didn't want to see how good the theory was. And so I made him the money back in a day. And that's when I decided I'm done with this life.
Yeah.
I'm not, because I put my mom in danger too. I think that was the huge wake up call for me. And my mom disciplined my brother. Now she spanked us when we were kids.
Oh, I believe in it. 100%.
Yeah. She gave it to my brother and I. And what that instilled in me, even though I did do wrong things later, was that still instilled in me this concept of consequences for actions.
Yeah.
So when that situation happened with that drug dealer, that was my major consequence for my action. And I didn't want the consequences to get deeper. And so that's when I decided I'm done with the street life. Mm-hmm. For 6 months, I did absolutely nothing. I just laid in bed and meandered around, and my mom was always telling me, go get a job. You need to get, I'm not taking care of a kid, no grown man. And then finally, you know, fast forward June of 2002, I was lying in my bed and I felt this presence. I felt this voice tell me, you need to get out of here. You need to join the military. And in all honesty, I got up, I looked around. I was like, who said that? Where did that come from? Because I had no faith background at this time. In retrospect, I truly believe that it was God guiding me. Mm-hmm. At the time, I thought it was my subconscious because it was so prevalent. And I just decided, I just said, well, military, why? You know, military is totally contrary to everything I am. I hated the police. You know, I had a lot of run-ins with the police. I saw a lot of things that shouldn't have happened in the inner city, you know, with the police and minority community.
Right.
And I associated anybody in a uniform as a police officer. I didn't like authority. I like my clothes, my hat's backwards and my clothes baggy. I liked life a certain way. And the military was totally opposed to everything I was and everything that I stood for. But after a few minutes of contemplating even further, I looked around this room that I had lived in since my dad died when I was 5, and I was just like, what else do I have left? My life has amounted to nothing. What else are you going to do with your life, Remy? And that's when I was like, screw it, why not? And I ran down the street I grew up on, and I went to the Marine recruiter's office first, by the way. and I sat there for 15 minutes. There was coffee on the desk, but he must have been taking a dump or something, because he didn't come back for 15 minutes. And he didn't. And I got up and left because he never showed up. And I walked down two doors down to the Navy recruiter's office, and it was this gorgeous Puerto Rican Navy recruiter in there named Tiana Reyes.
They do that to you.
Yeah, they do that to you, man.
She's
the pretty people in the office.
And I saw it out in my mind. I'm like, I'm gonna get this girl. She's gonna be my girl listening. And she saw that. I was like, she asked me what I want to do. I'm like, yeah, I'm gonna be a Navy SEAL. I'm gonna be a Navy. She's like, yeah, whatever. And she ran my background, found I had two warrants out for my arrest. I had a warrant in New Jersey and a warrant in New York. And I got up and got ready to run out the office. And she said, where are you going? I said, I'm getting out of here. Because she said, I got warrants. And she said, you have a suit? And I said, no. She said, do you have a collar shirt and some pants? I said, yes. She said, come back tomorrow. I came back the next day, and she was in her dress uniform, and she took me to both judges. This was right after 9/11. She took me to the judge in Jersey, the judge in New York, advocated on my behalf, told him, hey, this guy's trying to join the Navy after an act of war. 9/11 just took place. Can we expunge his record? Both of them expunged my record, and then she fudged my paperwork and snuck me in, and that's how I got into the Navy. That's how it all happened. And her act of what she did kept me from doing things that I shouldn't have done in the Navy. You know, because I wanted, you know, I wanted her to know that the decision she made wasn't in vain, you know. And so that's why I wanted to be the best sailor I could be because of what she did, you know.
And you by your own admission, I mean, your life has been influenced very heavily by women.
Yeah,
by a lot of
absolutely.
Women. We talk about fathers. But that's not to discount the role that women play in our lives. Mothers, of course, but also these mother figures.
I mean, throughout my life, I didn't realize that until I finished writing the book. I finished writing the book, and I went through it, and I was just like, wow, there's Tiana, there's my mom, there's my Aunt Doki, because I still had to pay off the court fees.
I want an Aunt Doki.
Yeah.
That's cool.
She's going to be 101 in a few months. Yeah, she's still alive. She's about
go
to fly.
Go get Bougie out there. Steve, check it. You keep peeking through. Go get Bougie and let him in here. Aunt Doki going to be 101 years old.
Yeah, she's about to get on a plane to fly to San Diego in 2 days to come be with me for Father's Day.
I love it.
And she pulled out all the money out of her savings account to help me pay off my court fees and fines and stuff. And when you go through the book, you'll see the HM2 that allowed me to work out so that I could get right to get into SEAL training. You know, so many women, women. Yeah.
SEAL training.
Yeah, man.
Everybody's got their stories on that.
Yeah.
How rough was that on you?
It was horrible, man.
Yeah, I can't imagine.
I mean, there's guys who are like, oh, it sucked. Yeah. I mean, straight up. I mean, it was.
What's the saying? The only easy day was yesterday.
And I went in not knowing how to swim.
Oh, boy.
So, you know, it was even harder for me. There were times when we had to, I mean, and once a week we had to do 2 mile timed ocean swims. And I failed every single one of them, you know, my first go round. And
I'm always fascinated with how many SEALs don't like the water. Like Chris Kyle didn't like the water.
I didn't know that. I didn't know
Chris
didn't like the water.
He did not like the water. But I run into a lot of different guys who are SEALs, and they're like,
Yeah.
not my thing. But I'm like, if you're going to make me swim 23 miles, I wouldn't like the freaking water either.
No, no. And that water is cold, man. No. That water is cold. I mean, but at the end of every swim, I was either borderline hypothermic or hypothermic. Wow. My lowest core temperature at one point was 88.7 because I had no body fat. I had just muscle, and it was just that's the worst part of SEAL. That was the worst part of SEAL training for me, was the cold.
Yeah.
Because they torture you with it, you know, and the mind games I could take growing up in the Bronx, that prepared me for that. The push-ups, the sit-ups, the runs, all that I could take, you know, I prepared physically. It was that cold water, man.
Yeah,
thing has a
wear. See, that's hard for me. I don't like cold at all. You talk about Nigeria.
Yeah, like, man.
One of my trips over there, I can remember coldest water I ever been in was in Moscow for 15 days because it was summertime and they cut all the hot water off.
Oh, wow.
Right? And
wow.
So you had it, if you're going to bathe.
Yeah, it's going to be
cold. If you're going to take a shower, and that's Moscow, Russia.
Yeah.
But I can remember being in Nigeria for a month one time, and the only hot water I got was at a place I stayed up in Abuja, and I was so happy to take that hot shower
because
I can't stand it. I don't know how you do it. Yeah. And I'm talking about, like, you're sacrificing for the country.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to take a shower.
You're just trying to take a shower, man.
That's brutal.
Yeah,
so like, I sacrificed too, Remy. I sacrificed.
You did. Here you go.
I gave for my country.
For the people in Nigeria.
I went to Nigeria and took a cold shower. Now I do it every morning with my wife.
I don't. I don't get nowhere near cold water. Well, I don't get that. No, I mean, I'll take a shot of my wife, but I don't get anywhere near cold water anymore.
No.
I can't take it.
I don't like to go. I don't want to go swimming in the pool.
Me neither.
I mean, it's just like I'll be by the water or on the water. I'm not a fan of getting in the water.
Yeah.
You know, my wife loves a scuba or snorkel and all that junk. I'm like.
Unless it's hot.
Yeah.
I don't like it.
I know.
Yes,
but
sir.
You came through it.
Yeah.
You didn't ring the bell.
Went through my graduating class. Started out with 270, only 29 of us graduated. So, I mean, yeah, and that's the way it is every class, you know? And I think I was around the 50th in the history, African American in the history of the SEAL teams to make it through. Because since 1962, you know, it's less than 1% are African Americans that make it in the special operations in general. So, you get one a class, or sometimes you get none a class. So, you know, I was that one.
I'm curious, how did all of a sudden now you're in the Navy and you got a lot of men yelling at you?
Yeah.
Putting you through this training and playing the mind games. How did that affect you with what you were already experiencing psychologically and spiritually, not having a dad? Did it affect you?
In a negative way, no, because I knew that it was all for a purpose.
Yeah.
You know, I knew that it wasn't, you know, malicious, and it wasn't, you know, wasn't being done just to make fun of me or just to say what I know it was being done to weed out the weak in order to see who's the strongest. And I wanted to pass that test every time. I didn't want to quit because I wanted to be that one of the last group of men standing. And so it didn't affect me in a negative. Now, there were times when I was laying in that cold water and I found this interesting when it happened, where it just sucked so bad. And I started crying out to my dad, not literally crying out, but just saying, "Dad, just help me, give me strength. Just give me strength to get through this evolution." There was times when I did that. But I found as time went on, you know, the instructors almost in some cases became like father figures to me.
Yeah.
You know, because that's where I really learned about, you know, integrity, you know what I mean? My mom taught me this, but it was more further reinforced, but doing whatever you do, do it with excellence. That's where I learned it from men for the first time, you know, in my life. You know, I had heard it from my mom, but that's where I really, so, you know, I have a chapter in there, in the book where I kind of discuss that, you know, I discuss, you know, that affirmation when I started to receive affirmation from my buds instructors, how that really, it really, kind of helped fill that void that I had for many years, not getting it from my father, but in a more cement concrete way versus when I was trying to get the affirmation from, you know, selling drugs and making money, that kind of thing.
Yeah. That's crazy, man. Hats off to you and thank you for doing it. Thank you for hanging on.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. I'm glad I did.
Yeah, because then I couldn't watch you in Transformers.
Yeah, I know.
That would be ludicrous.
I know. I want to have a book. I want to have the life I have. Yeah.
When did the book come out?
May 14th, so last month. Yeah.
So it's just been out right out of month.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is It's a fantastic book. I'm not finished with it. I'm like I told you, I always do my thing on my iPhone or whatever, and I read like 3 books a week. I've just recently gotten into yours, and it really is a good book.
Thank you.
And
I wrote it all myself. I didn't use a ghostwriter, and I have a co-writer. One thing I talk about in my book, and I touched on it earlier a bit, but my mom, she would make my brother and I write for punishment. She would make us, during the public education system in the Bronx was horrible at the time. Yeah. And to this day, it's still bad. And she was a teacher in the South Bronx, and she didn't want us to be a statistic. So she would, during the summer, she would make us do extra homework to prepare us for the upcoming year. So I got my principles and foundations as a writer, you know, as a young kid, 6, 7, 8, 9 years old. And then fast forward to my job in the SEAL teams, I did intelligence collection. And part of that is I had to write very long, detailed visual reports that would go up to different federal agencies, go up to generals, admirals. And so that's where my writing skills were really enhanced. And so I ended up writing a book, and that led to me writing other, you know, films and stuff like that.
Yeah. That's admirable. I mean, because this is a meaty book. This is not a pamphlet, folks.
Yeah, no, it's not.
This is not a pamphlet. I mean, you got a lot of pages in here.
Yeah, man.
And there's even some pictures right here in the middle. Now, don't get carried away. But there's Aunt Doki.
I love her.
I'm going to fly out to San Diego.
Yeah, man. Come hang.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Now, this is a good book. I encourage everybody to get transformed. A Navy SEAL's unlikely journey from the throne of Africa to the streets of the Bronx, defying all odds.
Mm.
And, I'm thankful for you, man.
Thank you.
Get the book, Transformed.
Yeah.
Remy Adeleke, and then just say that. It just rolls off the tongue.
There you go.
Remy Adeleke. Dude, you're always welcome here.
Thank you.
Always welcome to come on. I appreciate the time today and hanging out.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me on.
And check out the podcast, our guest and good friend of the podcast here, Mike Ritland.
Oh, yeah.
Everybody, you were recently on his.
Yeah, yeah.
And Mike does long-form podcasts.
Yeah, it's funny because I remember when he had me on, as I was driving there, I had like a flight that I had to catch like about 3 hours later. And I was like, hey, man, I got this flight I got to catch. He's like, oh, good. We'll just do half the time. So I'm figured, his half the time was 2 hours.
2 hours.
My half the time when he said that was 30 minutes. So I said to him, we don't need to do 30 minutes. I'm sure I could do an hour. He's like, no, my podcast is usually 4 hours. I was like, oh, man.
I'm like, so, Mike, are you lonely?
Yeah.
Like, are you lonely? Like, how is it that you get people on here to do 3 and 4 hour podcasts?
Well, it's strategic because the way the analytics work, from what I understand on iTunes, is it doesn't go by how many views.
Right.
It goes by how long a video is viewed. So that's how you...
You boost it up there, and that's exactly right. Like, what's the duration or the what's the word, Mark? The
time.
The retention rate.
Retention rate.
Got it.
The retention rate, and actually, oddly enough, ours is really good.
Yeah.
Like I think on a typical 45-minute show, our retention rate is like 35 minutes.
Oh, that's awesome.
Of a deal. So you know, because we are I figure hanging out 45 minutes to an hour, which is typically what we do, is long enough for folks.
Yeah.
I'm like, Mike, bro.
Yeah.
I'm like, I'll go to lunch with Mike. And I'm like, you don't have that much to say, man. I mean, he's kind of a quiet guy.
Yeah, he is.
You know?
Yeah, yeah.
And then I'm like, how do you do a 4-hour podcast with these people?
Yeah.
It's crazy, but he's a good dude.
He's a great dude. Awesome dude. Love that guy.
Dogs everywhere.
Yeah, man.
It's funny.
I'm happy for him, man.
Yeah, he's doing great. Things, that podcast is going good. And that's the Mic Drop podcast, M-I-K-E, just like his name.
Yeah.
Mic Drop podcast. I encourage people to go on there. You can get it on YouTube. Remy sits down with him for a long time.
Yeah.
And if you got sensitive ears, Ritland might not be the dude you want to listen to.
He calls it how he sees it.
He calls it. I just love that about it.
Yeah.
He's just real.
Yes,
and,
sir.
And he just says it the way he says it.
Yes,
sir. And I love the guy.
Yes, sir.
But no, he's a blast. And congratulations on all the success. I'm telling you, man, you're going to the top, baby.
All right.
Hollywood. Everybody comes to Hollywood has a dream.
Yeah, yeah, if you need an extra transformer,
I'll keep you in mind.
More than meets the eye.
All right, I'll keep you in mind.
I didn't like the Bumblebee movie,
more
though.
More than meets the eye.
I thought they were reaching with the Bumblebee movie.
Like, there wasn't a lot of action in that one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was a lot of, it was this, I don't know, it was weird.
Mm-hmm.
I had to make myself watch it. Shut up, Bougie. For those of you who don't know, Bougie Sean and Metro Jason just came in the room. Y'all can't see him. I hadn't seen him in a week. But anyway, Remy, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me on,
brother. I'm telling you, folks, go get the book. You got a website?
You can go to transformstory.com, but I'm on all social media platforms. Yeah. Remy Adeleke, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Transformedstory.com.
Yes, sir.
Get the book. download it where books are available. I don't care where you get them from. Amazon,
Barnes and Noble, wherever books are sold.
Do it. It's a good book.
Yes, sir.
Hey, you want to make a dent in the thing, and you don't complain about it. Do something about it.
Yeah.
And this is a good manual for that right here. Yes, sir. Appreciate the story.
Thank you.
Keep telling the story, man.
Will do. Will do.
All right. Hey, go to watchchad.com. If you get real bored, you can find me out across the country, going and going and going. We got Party Foul Steve's always on the road with me, and every now and then Bougie and Jason are there, too, keeping up. I got to have smart people around me.
Yeah.
People way smarter than me.
That's good.
Keep me straight, you know. Look at them over here. Like, Allison's over here. She's on her computer right now doing stuff for me. Is she doing stuff for me, Jason? Is she? Good. I better be pulled up on that computer 24 hours a day, girl. Mm-hmm. Is she, Mark? Is she representing?
Yeah.
Okay.
She's planning things right now.
Yeah, you got to keep these people straight.
There you go.
Yeah, listen. I ain't got money to burn, Steve. Steve thinks I do.
What?
Bougie, let me tell you this. You weren't in here. Partyfoul.com, I was trying to buy it. I was negotiating. The guy wanted $7,500 for it. Right? I offered up to $3,000 for it. And then he was willing to come to $5,500. The guy said, "Do you want to do $4,000?" I said, "I don't think so. I can sell just as much stuff on partyfoul.us, which I bought for $19 a year." Right? And Steve's like, "Yeah, but well, we could." And I'm like, idiot. Get the book. We're getting out of here. We love y'all. God bless you. We'll talk to you next time. Bye.